Harder They Come by Jimmy Cliff. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Next month marks the 75th anniversary of Social Security, the government's cornerstone program for tens of millions of retirees and people with disabilities. But in recent months, the attacks on the program FDR initialed on August 14, 1935, have steadily intensified. And Republicans aren't the only ones calling for cuts to Social Security benefits and raising the retirement age. Last month, during a speech on reducing the budget deficit, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer called for a higher retirement age. A week later, House Minority Leader John Boehner suggested raising the retirement age to 70 in a meeting with editors of the Pittsburgh Tribune. And in February, President Obama created a bipartisan 18-member commission to deal with the nation's public debt. The commission's report's due in November and is expected to recommend cuts to Social Security. For more on this issue, we're joined by economist Dean Baker. He's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and he co-authored a report called The Impact of Social Security Cuts on Retiree Income. Dean, where are we headed with Social Security right now, and what do you think needs to be done?
Well, it's very troublesome turf. Just to be very clear, absolutely nothing needs to be done. If we look at the projections from either Congressional Budget Office or the Social Security trustees, they've yet to come out with their new ones. But in any case, the one from last year, the program could pay all scheduled benefits well into the future, at least 27 years into the future. And even after that, it could still pay the vast majority of benefits, assuming nothing's ever done. Now, somewhere down the road, we'll probably make changes in the program as we've done in the past. But the idea that somehow something has to be done anywhere soon, this is crazy. People have paid for those benefits. So, in effect, what we'd be doing is defaulting on the bonds that are held in the trust fund to pay people their benefits that when they come due. So nothing has to be done. Now, what's going on is that you have this real craze about the deficit, because the reason we have the deficit, of course, was we had collapsed the housing bubble. But there's this obsession about the deficit. We have to do something. And you have people running around Washington saying, well, you know, we can't do anything on health care because we tried that and the insurance industry is too powerful, the pharmaceutical industry is too powerful, so therefore we have to cut Social Security. This is close to a non sequitur and should have people absolutely fuming at their representatives in Congress. But that's where we are in Washington.
What about this commission? This is President Obama's commission.
Well, the commission's very, very worrisome. It's chaired, you know, President Obama picked Alan Simpson, former senator from Wyoming, who's made a career out of beating up on old people. He thinks it's cute. I don't know if he's delusional or what, but he talks about how old people drive into their gated communities in their Lexuses. Maybe his friends do. We have the data. Very few others do. And then the Democratic co-chair was Erskine Bowles, who's getting he's a Wall Street guy. He gets over $300,000 a year as a director of Morgan Stanley, a firm that should be famous to everyone because it would be out of business without the taxpayers' support. And he right off the bat said, well, we're going to have to cut Social Security. So President Obama's two lead appointees, his co-chairs, are both on record saying they want to cut Social Security. This should have people very, very worried. That isn't a balanced commission.
Simpson was also recently quoted talking about older people as lesser people.
Yeah, Senator Simpson's quite a character. I mean, this whole commission is really fishy in any number of different ways. Among other things, they're holding their meetings in secret. But they even went a step further because you had a reporter, Alex Lawson, who works with the group Social Security Works, who interviewed Senator Simpson as he's going in or out of one of the meetings. And Simpson, you know, could not control himself, made this comment about lesser people, and was rather insulting, used several curse words. And I guess to avoid having Senator Simpson embarrass himself again, they now not only have the meetings in secret, but they actually do not disclose the location so that you won't have another occasion where a reporter asks Senator Simpson questions and then he makes a fool of himself, essentially. So, again, this should be disconcerting.
Andy Stern, a key member of the Deficit Commission, is pushing to invest a significant portion of the Social Security Trust in private companies through the stock market on Wall Street.
Well, what Stern, again, I don't know the full reference, but the way this is usually talked about, I assume this is what Stern meant, was that he would put some of the funds in an index fund, which, given that the stock market has plunged, people have asked me about it. I go, I don't see a risk there. So I'm not particularly concerned about that one. I'm concerned about individual accounts. I'm concerned about cuts in benefits. but that you had put some of the trust fund in the stock market. I mean, you'd almost have to come up with like a story like the moon hitting the earth to say how that would give us worse returns than what we would otherwise get at this point. So that one really doesn't have me concerned.
Dean Baker, what about lifting the retirement age to 70? What would be the effect?
Well, this is a cut in benefits, and of course, this disproportionately hits those who are at the bottom of shorter life expectancies and also who don't have the ability to make this up by working longer because they don't have the health or they have harder jobs. It really is infuriating. You go around Washington, all the people talk about this, they're all, you know, they have jobs like I do. I sit at a desk. I'm hoping I could work till 70, maybe much longer. I like my job. I'm, you know, from good health. But you go around, you go people working in a factory, people working in restaurants, you know, wait people. You look around at the jobs people have throughout society, the vast majority of those are not jobs where people could really look forward to working till age 70. So this is really kind of a cruel joke on people. And again, one other point I just think we can't emphasize enough. People have paid for these benefits. So we're talking about taking away benefits people are paid for. Let's use the word tax. Let's call it a tax. I know that sends the right wing nuts. Let's say they want to tax Social Security benefits because that's in effect what they want to do.
We're going to leave it there, but we're going to continue our conversation online just after the show, so people can go to our website at democracynow.org. Dean Baker, economist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, part two on the web. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shrufa Dokudu, Saren Mattei, Anjali Kamat, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Miguel Nogueira, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Nick Gela. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 8:01. Coming up next, it's More Talk Radio. Today's host, Celeste Curie, hosts a panel discussion with members of the recent Portland Playhouse production of August Wilson's play Radio Golf.
Roots music lovers, KBOO is proud to announce Pickathon 2010, August 6th through the 8th at Pendarvis Farm. Over 35 artists will help celebrate this year's Pickathon, including Martha Scanlon, Bonnie Prince Billy and the Cairo, Dr. Dog, Langhorne Slim, T-Model Ford, and many, many more.
I was standing, you were there.
Pickathon features five stages, the Galaxy Barn, 80 acres of camping, hiking, music and dance workshops, food and crafts, the beer garden, and many activities for kids, including a performance by Captain Bog and Salty. Pendarvis Farm is located near Southeast Foster and 172nd, with biofuel transportation from the Gateway MAX station by Eco Shuttle. Tickets and directions available at pickathon.com. Please, no dogs, glass, or outside alcohol will be allowed on site. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Pickathon 2010, August 6th through the 8th at Pendarvis Farm. See you there.
Proud to support PDX Bridge Festival, 2 weeks of arts and culture celebrating the bridges that connect us all.
PDX Bridge Festival is art, education, PDX Bridge Festival infrastructure, performance, transportation,
film, installations, history, tours.
PDX Bridge Festival is an expression of Portland's creativity. More than 2 weeks of arts and culture on and around the bridges that connect us all. July 23rd to August 8th.
PDXBridgeFestival.org.
Thank you. Good morning, good morning, good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the Portland metropolitan area, in Corvallis, Albany, Salem. We are 100.7. In Hood River, we are 91.9. And in the ether, which may look slightly overcast, but will be bright and sunny shortly, we are www.kboo.fm. Ladies and gentlemen, this is More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO. I'm Celeste Carey, your host, flying solo today, but I'm here with good company, good company. Some time ago, about, a year and three quarters or so ago, we had in the midst of the heart of Portland's soulful community a sprouting. And the sprouting was taking place on hallowed ground and given bearing hallowed fruit, if you will. What are you talking about, Celeste? What? Hallowed fruit? Yes, we're talking about words. We're talking about action. We're talking about ideas and broadening horizons. Portland Playhouse emerged on the scene. It emerged in what had formerly been a Baptist church, but it grew to understand that those roots in that church gave it a unique perspective in the community, a unique perch, if you will, for some activism and art. And so today we'll take a chance, we'll take a time, we'll have a moment to speak with three members of a recent production and give you a chance to hear what they've got in store for you in the future as they try to broaden your horizons and take you to other places, other vistas, challenge you politically and socially. I have with me here today Brian Weaver of Portland Playhouse, one of the founding brothers.
Yeah.
Okay. I've got with me here Ayanna Cunningham, who is the outreach media.
Yeah, I do outreach on this production of Radio
okay.
Golf.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I have with me Drammy Award winner. Did you think you were going to get away and not hear that? Kevin
oh,
E. Jones, who was one of the takeaway stars. He just took it all away. And the recent production of August Wilson's play, Radio Golf.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here this morning.
Thank you for being here. It's good to be here.
And we will give you a chance to talk about that from your own perspective, Kevin. I'm not going to just drop it.
Yeah. That sounds
well,
good.
I know there's been coverage in a lot of our local press, but it's a little bit different when we get a chance to sit up here and talk together about the kinds of things that motivated you and brought you here and helped you put together some pieces of work, which I understand some people felt were very appropriately controversial or stimulating at least. And so first, just a little bit of information, Brian, what brought you here to Portland? Why Portland? Why a church in North Portland, Northeast Portland, especially given some of the challenges that the city has had with redevelopment?
My brother and I, my brother's a businessman and I've always been an artist. The two of us were looking for a place to move that we thought was one of the most exciting places to go, and we chose Portland. We ended up in the King neighborhood, partly because we were looking for the cheapest place to live we could find, but also because, you know, it was important to move into a neighborhood that had a sense of community. We could get to know the neighbors, and we felt welcome when we arrived.
And church just basically turned up. We'll call it a fortuitous experiment. Or
we were walking around, biking around the neighborhood, looking for any vacant
any
building
property
we could find. We almost did our first play in an abandoned carpet warehouse. That would have been a little bit illegal. But then through a friend of a friend, it was a barbecue, I think, our first weekend here, someone said, oh, you should talk to David Morrison. He has this church. It's been used for a number of things for the 8 years since it had been a church. And we walked into the building, and it was so beautiful. It had a warmth. The sound resonated. It was packed. wall to wall with all sorts of interesting antiques, and it's been a great place to play in.
Well, it's certainly a community magnet because here in, especially in a part of the neighborhood you're in, you can drive every few blocks and you'll find a church.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting place because within the black community nationwide, doesn't matter where you go, there's been church on top of church that's been not just a social, not just a spiritual center, but the cultural center, the political center of the community. So in many ways, as I said, it sounds like a fortuitous adventure. We'll call it an adventure. And so you came to Portland and you decided you're going to have this playhouse and you opened with a few plays and you had some measure of happiness with it, but you decided to just purposely turn things on its head and do August Wilson out of the blue. How did that happen?
I've always been a huge fan of August Wilson. I lived in Seattle for a couple years and was able to see a number of his plays there. And so I guess when we decided to do a Wilson play, we didn't think that that would be strange or difficult, or we just it was a play that I loved. And it was only after we announced that we were going to do it that people started saying, "You're doing what? Or how are you going to do that? Who are you going to do it with? What do you mean, who are we going to do it with? We're going to have auditions and mm-hmm. see who shows up." And that was about the time that someone said, "You should talk to Kevin Jones."
Mm-hmm.
And so I gave Kevin a call and he said, "Well, let's meet for coffee and talk about it."
Well, before we go there, well, why was all the controversy? Now, I know, but some of our listeners may not know why hearing a young man from the East Coast, all excited and full of promise, producing a play by August Wilson would be a controversy. Why?
I don't know, Kevin. Do you want
to? No, you know the reason I'm asking is because you said you'd seen a lot of them in Seattle,
yeah.
And so I'm assuming that when you went to Seattle and saw them, there must have been something that struck you about the plays that made you decide to do them without even really thinking about what it was you were seeing.
Yeah, you know, it's probably true that there is not a huge African American audience in a lot of theater,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, I had just seen a Wilson play in Boston the year before, and it's great for a Wilson play. Everybody turns up. The audience is a complete mix of black people, white people. You know, it's also an audience that really brings young people, old people, people. It's a wonderfully mixed audience, and a fairly engaged, excited audience. And so I had that experience in New York, in Boston, in Seattle.
Okay. So then you're excited. You're going to produce this play and direct this play, and somebody says, "Well, I really applaud all your energy and your verve, but I think you need to call up Kevin." So enter Kevin, stage right.
Yeah, right. Was it stage right?
Well, you are now.
Yeah, okay. Well, actually, Brian and I met in an audition, and we were auditioning for American Buffalo, Third Rail, and there was an actor there, and he said to Brian, "You should talk to Kevin Jones." And so we met real briefly, and then we then talked on the phone, and we sat down, and you know, I'm from the East Coast, and you know, there have been a lot of rumors, really, and misnomers actually about who can do August Wilson and who can direct it and what race you need to be. And while he was alive, I mean, he was very clear that he wanted a black director to do his plays for two reasons. One, for economics, that there weren't a whole lot of plays for black directors to do. And the other was that he felt that black directors could speak more and understand more of the black experience, some of the nuances and subtleties and so on and so forth. So I had a conversation with Brian, and I said to him, I said, "You're lucky to meet me because I'm probably one of the few actors in town that doesn't care if I never work in this town again. So I'm going to tell you the truth." And Brian just looked at me with this sort of innocent smile and just kind of looked at me and said, "Okay, go ahead, you know." And I just asked him, I says, what are you up to? And he said, pretty much what he told you. He says, I love August Wilson and I want to do it. And I said, okay. So we had a good conversation, I thought, and he's nodding. I just sort of put out an email, broadcast to all of the good actors that I knew in town. I don't know that many, but a few. And the next thing you know, we were doing a reading. And the next thing you know, Brian was doing auditions. And so does that answer your question?
Or? That answers the question pretty much. Okay. And it leaves just enough to people's imagination to understand how excitement and energy that you saw in the plays, Brian, would capture your imagination and think, I've got to do that. I've got to have that. I want that in my little chapel of art. Mm. And so here we are. We've got this energetic young white man who's come with a vision, and then we've got you've been called the veteran actor.
Yeah, that's because I'm old. You get that when you get old. When you're older.
Older, you know. Okay. Say the eldest. See, I wouldn't call you old.
Well, you know how it is. You start to feel old, you know. It's like when you get to be 50 or over, it's always, I'm 50 years old. It's not, I'm just 50. I'm 58 years old.
Oh, okay. But nonetheless, you know, you come and you say, okay, let us have a moment of grounding here in reality. Mm-hmm. And look at what it is exactly we can do with this play. Mm. So I do want to let people know that this is call in. You can call in and talk with Ayana or Kevin or talk with Brian, and we'll talk about the play Radio Gulf. We'll talk about the Portland Playhouse Theater. We'll also talk about what their upcoming season holds for us, and then just some thoughts about how art can stimulate change in life. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 91.9 in Hood River, 100.7 in the Willamette Valley, and in the ether, it's KBOO.FM. I'm Celeste here on More Talk Radio, and we're talking about the recent production of August Wilson's play, part of his saga, Radio Gulf, which was the last in the series. And just a little bit about how the play aptly and in many ways uncannily, thanks to the really insightful direction and acting, reflected a lot of what Portland is going through right now. What Portland is going through right now, mirrored by that, is in some ways, it's no surprise. I mean, it's happened nationwide. You know, actually, if you listen to some of the news from Europe, even though some of the players are different, they're experiencing their own forms analogous to our gentrification. But I thought that was a pretty bold move on your part, even given that you already had a love affair with August Wilson. Did you think about how the play might be received by the performers themselves, the actors themselves, and whether they would jump at the challenge of displaying, expressing, presenting some of the nuances of Black life that Wilson had written in? Or did you think, you know, this is going to be a ship of fools? You know, it's just not, it's not going to sail. We're not going to go anywhere. Titanic's not going to have anything on us.
Well, actors always want to act, so I knew it wasn't going to be hard to find people who wanted to play those roles. Those roles are juicy.
They are juicy.
Talking about Kevin being old, you know, when I met Kevin, I thought that he was going to play the mayor candidate. I thought, here's a guy who could play 40, 45. The first time he showed up as old Joe, he walked in, he had this sort of shuffle, he was already stepping into the body of this 80-year-old man. I thought, who is this guy? Victor told me, he said, you got to watch him. Victor and I were standing at the doorsteps of the church watching Kevin get out of the car. We're like, he is already in character. His hand is sort of shaking as he's putting his coffee, is getting the keys out of his pocket. It's like, look at that guy. So he's not as old as he appeared to be as old Joe.
Thanks, Brian. I appreciate that.
But no, I didn't think about the actors. It slowly started occurring to me how much I was thinking about myself, or we were thinking about ourselves moving to do a play about assimilation and about gentrification as we were also taking part in that process. My cousins had bought a house on Congress, mm-hmm. On Congress in Albina 6 years previously. And when they moved into that house and I was there, we closed on the deal together. I was there and, you know, the house was covered in graffiti. Windows were broken. There were a couple bullet holes. There was, some spray paint in the basement that said something the bank. And it was mostly African American persons on, you know, in the eight blocks around them. And in the 6 years between then and when Nikki and my brother and I bought our house, that had changed. You know, almost completely.
Almost completely.
Almost completely. Yeah.
In preparing for getting the word out and getting the audiences out, you came up with what I thought was a unique idea to engage folks and to really capitalize on all of the energy that the actors were putting in, you know, and the nature of the play, the subject matter of the play, and that was by having talkbacks. And then that's where I met you, Ayanna, was mm-hmm. recruiting people to do that. Well, tell us a little bit about how you came up with the idea and why you thought it was really important to do it for this particular play.
Well, I knew with the theme of this play, being the most recent in the August Wilson cycle and the most contemporary, set more or less in our times, even though it takes place in the 90s, the themes of the play were so true to what to the change that we're experiencing in the neighborhood where the playhouse is located and where myself and Brian both live, mm-hmm. with gentrification happening and businesses losing foothold and so much change sweeping over, that when the choice is made to produce this play, I was struck very deeply by we can't just put this on and put out flyers and say, hey, come see our play. This play called for inviting in the community and bringing people in to extend the conversation beyond just being an audience member. And I knew that there were resources in our community. There are already a number of people having these conversations and pulling people together and trying to talk about what is the change that is happening in our neighborhoods? What does it mean to the people that have lived here for a long time? And what does it mean to the new people coming into our neighborhood? What are different ways that we can bring people together and extend this conversation? So I knew there are a lot of people that were already quite engaged in this kind of talk. And I thought, well, if we're putting the show on, we need to find a way to bring people together in the playhouse and get them not only excited about seeing the work, but to have a place where they can contribute them their own stories and passions about that. And that's when I reached out to you and other community members, such as the Restorative Listening Project and our United Villages.
And I believe it was one of the most enjoyable experiences I had with a play. I'm sure the rest of the folks did with the talkback. And speaking of talkback, we have a few folks holding here on the line, and I do want to get to my callers. You are welcome to come and join the conversation with us. The number is 503-231-8187 here on More Talk Radio with my guests, Ayanna and Brian and Kevin of the recent Portland Playhouse and Base Roots Theater Company production of Radio Gulf. Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Good. What's up?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think the church has failed miserably in terms of its role as being the only black institution that black people have out here, that they didn't talk about gentrification a long time ago. Right now, it's sort of like too late. It's done. And so right now, if you're talking about gentrification, I mean, it's too late. And the thing about it is that the groups that came in, like Habitat for Humanity and all these tax abatement programs, and the police station. These are the some of the players that brought gentrification in Northeast Portland. So I haven't seen you play, so I don't know too much about
have you,
it.
Have you read any of Wilson's plays?
No, I don't know anything about it. I've been listening to you guys, and so far you guys have been a little esoteric because you assume that your audience know what you're talking about, and I don't think most of them do.
No, that's true. There's a lot of folks who haven't seen the play, which is one of the reasons why we're talking a lot about how it fits into the Black experience. It's unfortunate that you haven't read anything, because one of the things that was really most striking about Wilson's play was the fact that he layered in a lot of the concerns that you've had in this play. You know, he talked about the how members of the community both rise up to the occasion and fail the occasion. And so some of what you've said, it mirrors a lot of the dialogue, a lot of the energy in the play. What do you think about that, Brian and Kevin?
If the church has... if it's too late to talk about gentrification, I don't think so. Because one of the talkbacks, someone said, "What can we do? Is there anything we can do to make a difference?" And one of our panelists, I forget who it was, maybe Ayana, you remember who said this? Said, "Well, sure, you can start talking to people. If you see someone out who, on the street who doesn't look like you, or maybe has a different experience than yours, say, 'Good morning. How's it going?'" It's for me who has just moved to the neighborhood in the last 2 years, it's easier to talk to people who are similar to me. So it's easier to talk. It happens all the time. You're like, "Oh, how long have you been here?" "Oh, a year." When did you move to Portland?" "Oh, just in the last year." What do you do? "Oh, I'm an artist." There's a lot of similarity, but it's a little more of a leap to talk to someone, say, "How long have you been in the neighborhood?" "Oh, 60 years." "Oh, really? 60 years? What do you do?" "I'm a retired school teacher." "Oh, interesting." But once you make that leap to ask to have the same conversation with someone where the answers will be different than, "Oh, I moved here last year," you find that our community will be stronger, that the relationships to have a mixed neighborhood that is... Building community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm interested in the caller's comments in terms of what the church has done. I first of all, Portland Playhouse is a theater, so it does plays. It's not a church. It was done in a church, so there is some symbolic relevancy there. But without the caller knowing anything about the play, I mean, just briefly, the play is about regentrification that occurs in Pittsburgh. And it's not about what the community outside is doing, the outside community is doing in the Black neighborhood. It's about what Black people are doing with each other on the level of gentrification. It's about how the African American has become inculcated by the mainstream economic goals.
Totally absorbed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not someone coming from outside the community and saying, "Okay, we're going to split everything up. We're going to buy everything up." It's about how Black people are striving to get ahead and how they see this as an opportunity to move forward. It's about a Black man who is conflicted by that, who's running for mayor and, is spearheading this gentrification, but at the same time is being reminded by some of the stories of the people who have been there, who've lived there, who have history there, who have a life there, who have it's part of who they are and are not quite ready to let it go. And that's what theater does. Theater does not answer questions. Good theater doesn't answer questions. Theater brings up questions. It brings up questions, and that's why I think the talkback was so powerful. Is that if you had come, we wanted to see a lot of people from the neighborhood come. We'd really reached out for that. I went to the Columbia Villa, and we showed a film about the the gentrification that happened
say,
there.
Say New Columbia.
New Columbia.
So they still like us.
New Columbia. Thank you. You're right. Thank you. See, and I didn't even know. I mean, I guess I did know that. Uh-huh. I forgot it. But yes, mm-hmm. you know, it's a very, very sensitive issue. So I'm not going to talk about it too much because I'm liable to say a whole lot of stuff that's wrong. Yeah. So anyway, that's really all I have to say about that. I think that it's unfortunate that more black people didn't come to the play. It's unfortunate that there weren't more people from the black community that weren't part of the talk back. But we did have a few. So anyway.
Yes. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to say to the caller, if you hear of any of Wilson's work being performed, take a moment to go see it. The whole idea about talking about this play is not just about who failed and who didn't fail, but looking at different ways in which we interact. You mentioned, gentrification as being one of the themes in the movie, and also family and doing the right thing and understanding what are the sacrifices for mm-hmm. progress are some of the themes in the movie. And these are no stranger to the black community. They're no stranger to anyone's community. They're part of the human community. And so in many ways, although the plays feature very distinct and very palpable aspects of black life, they're about human beings, human life. You can take this story and you can put it anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Join in the conversation, 503-231-8187, and we'll go to our next caller. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Miss Celeste.
How are you doing?
You never cease to amaze me with your resourcefulness. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
I had the great privilege of interviewing the Honorable August Wilson right before he died. Actually, he was in the late 90s.
Mm.
And just to respond to your caller, no, this conversation is not esoteric. There's a responsibility that we have to keep up with the black canon. And your guest is right that theater does propose questions. And not necessarily in a parallel world. But I want to ask you, Ms. Carey, do you think that the play, because I saw the play, the production here, Ms. Carey, do you think that there was too much left on the cutting room floor? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Wow. Too much left on the cutting room floor. Well, the way the question is phrased almost begs me to say yes. You know, and the reason I want to say that is because there are certain elements maybe that needed to have been emphasized more for an audience. But one of the things that I've learned in life, and especially since as an actor and as a director, and even, you know, someone who is going out to bring people in, you know, there's this thing called the soft touch. And so you want to try to work for the soft touch so that you leave space for questions. You don't create a fixed image in somebody's mind and therefore freeze their idea of what should have been said or shouldn't have been said. Your thoughts on that, my esteemed colleagues?
Well, I think that Wilson left before it went to New York. At the end of the play, the character Harmon Wilkes, who is a candidate for mayor, he and his friend Roosevelt have a development project, and they're doing it in the Hill District, and they're putting in a Barnes & Noble and a Starbucks and a block of apartments. And it's
all of the things that are the trappings of quote-unquote success.
Yeah, and as they are really succeeding, really hitting financial success and also political success, a character enters, Old Joe, who starts reminding him of the importance of history, the history of the neighborhood, and in particular one house that's on the development site that he doesn't want to be knocked down because it happens to be his house. Slowly in the play, Harmon's conscience is turned, and he in the end decides to fight for the house, to turn his back on the whole development project. He ends up losing his bid for mayor, and ultimately he probably will lose the battle with the development. The end of the play can be left a question as to whether he made the correct choice or not. Mm-hmm. Was it right for him to sacrifice his own political career, his friends, financial advantage for the neighborhood, just for one raggedy house, as one of the characters says? And for me, I always thought that it was a tragedy. It was a tragedy that he had to lose everything to retain this piece of history. And that the end of the play hangs with this question. When Wilson wrote it, the end of the play, whether he was going to walk out the door and as an activist, or whether he was going to stay in the room and ponder the question, was up for grabs. When they moved it to Broadway, they made a change one of the other characters, Sterling, put some paint on his face as to show that he's going to battle, war paint. And I believe after Wilson passed away, they made this change that Harmon would put paint on his face so that he was going to battle. And I, as a director, I had thought, I don't know if we want to go to battle, if that's the answer. But in rehearsal, both of the actors who played that role, there was no question they wanted to go to battle. And it seemed like that was the feeling among the cast, too, that Harmon, at the end, that he had become an activist. So he was not leaving the question up for grabs. He wanted to go to battle.
Kevin?
I'm just getting chills just being reminded of the play when I listen to Brian. It's still with me. Yeah, I guess I don't know what he means by, left on the cutting room floor.
The fact that the ending itself wasn't as it had been written, but just kind of truncated, just kind of cut off right there. Leaving more, I think, to the imagination and more to the possibility of character development, personal development.
Right. I mean, I think that, I mean, August Wilson, you know, does this dance in all of his plays between reality and myth. You know, there's mm-hmm. a fantasy, you know. And it, depending on the choice of the director and the actors, you know, it varies as to where you walk that line, what side of the line you walk on. But it's never, you know, explicated completely. It's never clear in any of his plays who's who and who's. I mean, Uncle Joe could have been a ghost, you know. I mean, and it could have been played easily as a ghost. But I think what August Wilson is able to do is pull out the themes. He pulls out themes and he tells stories around those themes. And some of those themes are based on what's happening now. Some of those themes are based on what happened 300-400 years ago. I mean, like, if you read his plays, you know, there's Aunt Esther. Aunt Esther's 365 years old. She's still talked about. She's in a lot of her plays. Mm-hmm. What is that all about? You know, I mean, so to say that there's a lot left on the cutting room floor, I guess that's true. And I think there's a lot that's brought in also into the story that we don't think about, which is what I love about his plays, is that he brings in themes that we forget about. You know, I mean, we're talking about gentrification. That's something that happens now. You know, we don't think about, you know, where we, you know, all of the things that led up to that. We don't think about how the African American is actually bought into that, how we see that as an economic vehicle to overcome our demise. You know, we don't see what it's done to the African American community and the division that's made in the African community. And you know, we are so often looking out as African Americans, looking out at what someone has done to us, as opposed to what has been left in the community that we do to each other. Mm-hmm. And I thought that
is left that's valuable.
Yes. Thank you. What's left that's valuable. And that's I think he does that beautifully. And so I'm not, you know, and I've seen all of his, I haven't seen Gem of the Ocean, but I've seen all of his other plays, and there's always that question at the end of the play, you know. Mm-hmm. It's all, I like the term left on the cutting room floor, even though it's out of context, but I like it. But I think that's the way it's supposed to be.
What came up for me with that question was maybe with this production, was there not enough answers under the fire that came up in the way that people had a very passionate reaction to the play and about North Portland and the changes happening there, was there not enough specifically addressed and not enough room for people to really open up and talk a little bit more about that? And did the play not give enough answers that people wanted? One thing that came up in a lot of the talkbacks and a lot of the audience participation was I found this play really revved people up and wanted them to talk and share their experiences. And it just reminded me of the hunger people have for connection.
Yes.
And answers, not just around gentrification, but, you know, really around racism and...
actually around life.
Around life, just around life and the suffering that I believe that everyone carries with them as they try to navigate these very, what seem to be complicated relationships that are happening in our neighborhood. And it's a very difficult place to go and a conversation to have. And I think this play just kind of thrust people into the room with that. And, you know, were things left out?
Yeah, Ayanna makes a good point. I was really struck by the talkbacks and how much conversation was evoked, how much emotion was evoked, and people were left wanting more. You know, I wasn't sure if they wanted more play or they wanted more dialogue, but there were other discussion groups that were created afterwards that took place in other, like the bookstore.
The talking drum.
Mm-hmm. Because people wanted to continue the conversation, and that's great.
Well, that says a lot about Portland, that there really is a desire to connect here. It's just a matter of getting out of our own way. Mm-hmm. But importantly, see, you started something.
Oh.
All of you, you started something. You know, you opened up the doors, you took a chance, you produced something. You took a piece of art that reflected and emulated and simulated life, and you made it life, and you made it breathe, and you made people talk back to you about that. We've got a little bit of time left. In that time, there's a few things I want to do. I'm hoping that since the play is over, what I'm doing is I'm both creating a hunger for people to read August Wilson's works, but more importantly, to get engaged. There's two groups that came together to make this play happen, that being the Portland Playhouse and then also Baseroots Theater. What's in store for collaborative efforts? What do you have planned coming up that might do the same thing in terms of turning Portland on its ear, opening Portland's heart, their ears, and most importantly, the mouth, too, to speak?
Well, I think this will be the first announcement of this. We've been meaning to get it up on our website or send out a press release, but we haven't gotten around to it yet. But next year we are doing... Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and we just got the rights for that a couple days ago or a week or so ago.
And, who's directing that?
And Kevin Jones, right here. So Kevin's directing Ma Rainey, which will be really exciting. It's fun to go from Radio Golf, which was Wilson's, the last play that he wrote, to Ma Rainey. I had to check this morning. I was about to say it was the first play that he wrote. It's not, certainly not. He wrote about seven plays before he wrote Ma Rainey. Ma Rainey is the first play that he wrote of the cycle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't take place first, but it was the first one that he wrote. It takes place in the 20s. So
why Ma Rainey, Kevin?
Because Brian wanted to do it. Brian's the boss.
A lot of people look at our little theater, the little church. They're like, mm-hmm. Oh, it's great. And people always bring me two person plays. They're like, mm-hmm. Oh, you know, it's nice. You have this little intimate space. And mm-hmm. They're like, how about this nice little play? And I thought we should do the biggest, most difficult, most sprawling Wilson play there is.
Oh, mm. God, is that right? Is that right? Well, I think it's a great play. I think, you know, again, the themes, you know, I heard Orcus Wilson being interviewed, and he was talking about Ma Rainey, and he was talking about his experience as an African-American in a white neighborhood, and he went into a restaurant, and he watched a group of Chinese men walk into the restaurant, and they sat down at a table, and they were very quiet and very polite, and you know, they talked in, you know, low tones and didn't want to disturb people, and they got up and they ate their food and they paid their bill and they left. And he said, and right after that, a group of about 7 black guys came in, and they were loud and they were yelling and screaming, and they were like, hey man, put something on the jukebox. No man, don't play that song, you played that last time. And he said, the waitress came, hey baby, let me talk to you. He said, no, don't talk to him, he can't read. And it was all this, you know, and what he was touched by was the lexicon, the way in which African Americans communicate with each other, and how that's the blues. All of that comes from the blues. And Ma Rainey has so many different colors and so many different themes going on. It's about the music industry and the beginning of jazz, and also it's about the great migration from the South to the North, and what that did to African Americans. And there's so many wonderful colorful characters. There's not one character in there that doesn't teach us something. And, you know, of course, then there's the music. There's Ma Rainey.
Oh, yes.
It's a very exciting play. In a lot of ways, it's a tragic play, but it can teach a lot if it's done well. And so I consider it to be an incredible challenge. I'm really grateful for Brian letting me do it. And I think it's going to be great. It gives us an opportunity to really reach out to the black actors community in Portland.
So will you be working in this as part of the Base Roots Theater Company?
Yes, we will. I mean, we'll reach out to whoever. I mean, Base Roots is definitely, if they're available, because they're busy, we will definitely reach out to them as well. For sure.
Well, I really want to encourage people to take advantage of theater. It doesn't have to be big and grandiose. It doesn't have to be ornate and exquisite. It can also be smaller and personable and visceral. But take advantage of what we have here in Portland. Mm-hmm. So with Ma Rainey's Black Bottom coming, what else are you going to add to the okay, I get in the high sound. We got another call. What else are you going to add to your bill for the season?
Well, we'll take a little lesson from Radio Golf and to follow the lines of intricate history.
I like
so,
that.
So another history connection we have. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom was actually done before in Portland, about 20 years ago, a theater company called Storefront Theater. And Storefront Theater, the history that I've learned about them, they were one of the first, I mean, what they are, Storefront Theater, they were one of the first small theater companies that went into an abandoned storefront, put up a sign, and started doing plays. And they did this play, Ma Rainey, 20 years ago. So we are doing a play by one of the founders of that company, by his younger brother, Nick Zagoni. Nick Zagoni is a Portland local, a writer. He's part of Playwrights West, which is a new playwright group, theater company in town. And we're doing his play, Missing Pieces. So we'll do that as part of the Fertile Ground Festival. It'll be in January. And then we're starting off the season with another, a new play, Telethon, by Kristen Neubaum, that Rose Reardon from Portland Center Stage is directing. And that was part of their Jaw Festival. It was a Jaw play in 2006, and the Jaw Festival is going on right now at Portland Center Stage.
Okay, so you know I'm going to ask you, Jaw Festival?
Jaw Festival, yeah. Jaw started as Just Add Water, but now I think it's just Jaw. And it's Portland Center Stage hosts some of the top playwrights from around the country. And all of the readings are free. It's going on this past weekend. There were 2 readings, and this coming weekend, Saturday and Sunday, there are 4 readings.
Great. So for more information, we can look on whose website
on
for this?
On Portland Center Stage.
Portland Center Stage. And then for your upcoming season list, we can go to your website, which is
portlandplayhouse.org.
Okay. And then Mr. Kevin E. Jones, winner of the Drammy Award, and I want you to take a moment to talk a little bit about this. Where can we find out more about what you're involved in?
I don't have a website.
No, but you have a couple of groups with whom you're affiliated.
Yeah, I'm affiliated right now with Portland Playhouse, and I was affiliated with Base Roots, mm-hmm. But because of my day job and other things, I had to step away from that. But I'm still in contact with them. I am part of the Jaw Festival right now that's going on. We're doing a great play. It's called Necessity by a guy by the name of William S. Gregory. And it's about an African-American community in New Orleans in 1917 during World War I. And it's a very beautiful play. It's done as sort of a Greek theater type setting with that kind of style. And it's very beautiful language and very educational. You know, I mean, just for, you know, as I'm not homegrown, I'm from outside the area. And as a African-American actor, it's been hard to find work. So work that I would want to do.
Now, nationwide or here?
Here in Portland. Mm-hmm. And so I'm, you know, just excited about the possibilities, you know, of doing more work. I think that, you know, it's, you know, I've always felt that, you know, if you give me a chance, I'll show you what I can do if you give me a good role. And so Brian was kind enough to trust me to do this role. And I'm proud of the work that I did. And I want to do more work like that, you know, and I want to, and not just in the vein of the African-American themes. But, you know, one of the things that happens is, as an actor, as a black actor, we get, you know, in film, you know, the agent calls you when there says on the script, in walks African American.
Right.
Or then you get a call, you know.
Yes.
Not in walks the teacher, in walks the lawyer, in walks the
doctor. In walks
doctor,
some human being that fits
yeah,
this particular
right,
character.
In walks 45-year-old mm-hmm. man, you know.
There you go.
So, you know, I you know, look to change that, you know, on every level I can. And sometimes, you know, when I talk about it, people take offense, but I try not to offend people by that. But I do want to, you know, be clear that there is that level of division that goes on within the theater community and within the acting world, is that we can do more than just play black people, and white people can do more than just play white people. You know?
So having won the Drammy Award, and Drammy being one of our homegrown awards that mm-hmm. we offer here, originating out of, what was it, the Willies?
The
Willamette Week started
Willies.
Back in the 70s.
Yeah.
So you've won that, which kind of cements both your assertion that you can show people something stellar,
right.
But also the fact that there is local recognition for jobs well done.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, someone called me up and said, you know, your price is just going up. Just
there
doubled.
You go.
I was like, okay, well, I'm waiting for that, you know. But yeah, I've gotten some calls. It's interesting, you know, that it's interesting, you know. It's like, I guess that's just what happens, you know. You get recognized and you become viral for a while anyway. Mm-hmm. I'd love to be able to, you know, maximize on that. I'm not sure what you're getting at. You look like, I get the impression you might be leading somewhere. Are you?
No, don't try to read.
Okay,
you
good.
Know, there's
okay,
nothing
good.
There. I'm
okay,
actually good. my next question actually was going to Yana, and I was thinking, good. Was there anything more I wanted to say? No, I need to leave a little for mystery, you know.
Okay,
I
good.
Like to leave a little for mystery.
Thank you. I like that. That's good.
Yes.
That's good.
I'm getting a high sign here. I haven't forgotten you now, so I want to make sure we get to you. But we'll go to our caller. Thanks for calling and holding. Good morning.
Good morning, wonderful host and panel. Reggae Bob Robert checking in this morning.
Good morning, Reggae Bob.
Good morning. Good morning. And Kevin, you mentioned you don't want to, you know, offend some people on your roles or your requests for roles or that you would take or not. It doesn't hurt to offend. We do that at cable all the time. It stimulates the mind.
You know, I was thinking, shall I tell him what he means? Is he wants to become, you know, a thorn in their side and they have to address it?
Yeah.
Now, Kevin, it'd be nice, brother, as an actor, I don't say you need, but it would be nice to have a website, a web page featuring yourself, because that's how people are doing a lot of stuff these days. They might hear about you. They might not know how to get in touch with you. They might have to go searching for you. If you have that page, and, you know, so let's have my phone number, and I got a good man who does pages. But speaking of plays, black plays.
Thank you. I'll keep that in mind, by the way.
Yeah, please do, man. It's an excellent tool. A couple of years ago when Fences came to town, August 1st.
Oh, yes. Yes.
My gosh, I hadn't been to a play in a long time, and Celeste, it was like sitting in and listening to my family talk and my family's turmoil.
Yes.
There's nothing like being at a play live.
Yes.
It was an amazing thing. And when you guys have your plays in town, if you could have maybe 3-4 seats off to the side each show for the community, like free seats, you'll sign up for free, distinguished guests for free, something like that. So people who can't afford these, even though they don't cost a lot, they could be the people that spread the word back out to the community, let them know what's going on. Thanks for taking my call.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah.
That's a great idea.
He tied right into it when he talked about getting the community in. And I know you've got a couple of products, or got an idea, rather, I should say, up your sleeve you want to share.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
She did it again.
It's not a big idea. No. I just know that with our next season, especially with Ma Rainey, we're especially looking to expand the community involvement more so. We had very successful talkbacks with Radio Golf. It was a success just to reach out to other community groups and make connections. And I'm hoping that during the production of Ma Rainey, we can expand that even further. I'd like to see more people from the King neighborhood to come and see the show, to participate. We'd love to have more students in to see the show. For Radio Golf, we were fortunate enough to have a grant for some free tickets. We hope that can happen again. So just putting it out there, if you're in a community group, if you're interested in participating with us and expanding our outreach, please get in touch.
Well, you know, I'll do whatever I can to make sure you do, because I love the fact that all we're doing is we're giving people an opportunity to think about life and each other, you know?
Yes.
And there's nothing better than being at a live play and watching somebody perform their art, looking at how everything has come together, you know, to prepare plays for it, and then watching the transformation as people think new thoughts about themselves and each other from being exposed to art. I love it, you know. So I have to thank you for coming in and sharing some of the excitement that's brewing in the community. And apologies for folks if, you know, we didn't go into the film in depth. As our caller Eugene said, you know, something left on the cutting floor. Well, I leave that so your imagination can make the picture that works for you, you know. It's kind of like when you go see a movie and it's turned into a blockbuster and the person that they picked to play the role doesn't look anything like the character you imagined for that role, you know. And so I like for there to be that open-ended question, that open-ended character. Any final words as we wrap this up? Brian, Ayana, Kevin?
I am just glad that we're doing this. You know, I hope that I'm going to start listening to KBOO more often. And
good.
Yeah. And, you know, it's nice to, you know, have a bit of an opportunity to talk about the aftermath and what's happened. And I hope that this creates a certain kind of momentum within the Black or African-American theater community, or with the African-American community. Just come to plays. Just go to plays. There's lots of stuff worth seeing, not just Black stuff. Just come to the theater. There's a play right there in the middle of the African-American community in the Northeast. And go to that theater.
Absolutely.
And we are interested in making it affordable. So please get in touch with us about that. We hear that not everybody has the money. If you're dying to come and see one of our shows, get in touch. We have Pay What You Will Thursday performances.
And it starts this next weekend, right, Kevin? What night's the show?
The Jaw. That's going to be on Saturday night. And by the way, one of the actors, the guy that played Troy in Fences, is in that show. So he played the lead, and he's great. He's a great, great, great actor to work with. And that's next Saturday.
Thanks for having us, Les.
Oh, it was
a
pleasure. It was a pleasure. We had Portland Playhouse. We had Brian Weaver, Ayana Cunningham, Kevin E. Jones. Hope you catch the plays. But we want you to stay tuned, because coming up here, 9 o'clock is the Old Mo Variety Hour. The theme is climate change and science fiction, imagining the future. 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. 10:15, Locust Focus. Host Barbara Bernstein looks at growing gardens. 11 o'clock, Dr. David Naiman speaks with Dr. Alan Logan, the author of Your Skin Younger. And at 11:30, hear the radio zine. All this and more on Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.